the show notes and guest host of Gorel Wolf's Geek Life. And you're listening to episode 21 of Murder at Abaddon Hill with P.G. Holyfield.
Welcome to the podcast presentation of Murder at Abaddon Hill, The Chronicles of Aramis Cragan, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to episode 21 of Murder at Abaddon Hill. This is P.G. Holyfield. We are going to skip the intro chatter, but please stay tuned for after the chapter because I've got a lot of information to share with you guys. Appearances in May, just a lot of information for people that are interested in the success of this podcast. So please stay tuned for that. I do want to say that before we get to the chapter itself, we will have a story so far from a loyal listener, Thomas Reed, and his daughter, Abby. And we're just going to get right into that. So here's the story so far, and then chapter 20.
Aramis
Cragan. Wait, you got to say who you are first.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll do it next.
Do it now.
Hi, I'm Abigail Reed.
And I'm Thomas Reed, otherwise known as Treed, and this is the story so far, and you can read now.
Okay. Aramis Cragan, a monk of the Aaronic Order, and his student, Aaron Partee, have arrived at Abaddon Hill, and I've been asked to investigate the murder of Greta Platt, housemistress of Abaddon Manor and counselor to Lord Abaddon. The two heroes have found werewolves, rumors of vampires, and secretive townspeople aplenty. But in Chapter 19, they learned that the town's herbalist might be creating a potion meant to save someone from transforming into a vampire. A decision is made, and at the end of the last episode, our heroes are approaching Abaddon Manor, needing to find a way in, undetected.
Okay, PJ. Bye.
Bye!
Episode 21 of Murder at Abaddon Hill.
Chapter 20. The Manor Calls. The Icon of Arjun, the Child of Protection. There will be a shelter to provide shade from the sun, and protection from the storm and the rain. Tales of the Children.
That is why we must enter the manor from a different direction. With those words, Aaron Partee realized that they were going to use the catacombs in an attempt to enter Abaddon Manor undetected. While initially excited at the prospect of action, what followed was the near certainty that they were going to incur the wrath of Lord Abaddon and in his own home. Aaron instinctively flexed the muscles of his shoulders until he felt the sword strapped against his back. Aaron looked over at the monk. The prince followed Aramis by a couple of steps, slightly to his right. From this vantage point, Aaron watched Aramis begin his mental preparation for what they were attempting to do. Aramis's connection to the land was palpable. He once described it to Aaron as feeling a sea breeze while walking along the beach, but all of the time. As they walked towards the stables and the entrance to the catacombs, Aaron imagined Aramis sensing the energy of the world around him, the light, the wind, the life force flowing through the air. To Aaron, it looked like Aramis was withdrawing into himself. To Aramis, however, it was the exact opposite. He was reaching out into the world around him. The increased level of concentration inherent to his connection to the land had served Aramis well during his life. This heightened consciousness gave him powers, certain control over the natural processes of the world. In this state, for example, he could see auras around people, and in turn see how they are connected to the river of magic flowing around them. It helped Aramis detect if someone was using magic, if someone was hiding something, or even to predict someone's actions. But his connection was all but severed when a tall figure approached them, one arm held high, seemingly ready to strike at them. For a moment, all Aramis could see before him was an aura of blue tinged with green. The aura disappeared, and all that was left was Father Joris. Aaron was as surprised as Aramis when Father Joris jumped out from behind the corner of his home and raised his holy symbol high above his head. Aramis stared at Father Joris for a moment, but did not move to defend himself. Aaron leaped forward and placed himself between Aramis and the priest. Not unlike the first time they had met Father Joris, the cleric's holy symbol of Arjun was lit by the unnatural light of the spirit, power granted to him by the Child of Protection. For a moment, it appeared that Father Joris was going to strike out at the taller Aaron, but after a tightening of his facial muscles and a blink of his eyes, Father Joris finally recognized the two men standing before him. Almost immediately, the light of his holy symbol began to fade into the darkening night.
Ha! Devils! What are you doing skulking around after dark?
Aramis had recovered his senses and had moved up beside Aaron.
We have an appointment. We will not keep you from your work, Father.
Joris's hair was tied back, a better look than the tangled mess of the day before. The braid was long, and he had it wrapped over his shoulder and down the front of his chest. Joris pulled on the braid lightly with his free hand.
You promised me you would join me in the cemetery this evening, monk.
Aramis opened his mouth, but Aaron spoke first.
This is the second time you have nearly attacked us with your symbol of Arjun, Father. You should be more careful.
All Aaron could see was the Father Joris from his dream the night before, standing over a beheaded corpse, laughing at his triumph over evil. Joris raised an eyebrow. He then extended his arm until the end of his weapon of light stopped just short of Aaron's chest.
And if you had been a vampire boy, the power of Arjun would have changed the blue of my holy symbol into the yellow fire of the sun.
Aaron stared at the symbol and watched it pulse weakly. Light. Dark. Light. Dark. Like a candle searching for a last bit of air in a collapsed mine.
And the heat of that sun would have burned the flesh from your bones.
Aramis countered.
Joris, as I told you, we have a prior commitment. If we complete this task before the end of the night, we will try to meet you.
Joris snorted. He moved forward and gripped the edge of Aramis's robe just below his neck. He whispered, even though Aaron stood right next to him and could clearly hear his words.
There are demons here, Aramis Clegane. You've seen this for yourself. Only fools would think the gates are shut for good. You are not a fool, are you, Clegane?
Aaron did not understand what Father Joris referred to, but it was obvious that Aramis was not happy about it.
Enough, Joris. There are many forms of evil in the world. Do not confuse what is happening here with the events of the past. We will meet you later, if we can.
He twisted himself in such a way that Father Joris lost his grip on Aramis's robes.
Come. Aaron,
We have work to do. They left Father Joris and continued east until they reached the stables. They heard several horses, but they were relatively sure Lon Garrett and Shane Olivet had gone home for the night. Aramis pulled out his notebook and tried to look over some of his notes. He held it up at eye level, trying to catch the light from a nearby house. This is going to be harder than I thought. Aaron thought they might head over to Cousin Red's home to regroup, but Aaron could see that his window was dark as well. He's probably working at the inn tonight. Aramis couldn't read his own notes, so he changed his approach and began to search for the secret entrance to the catacombs based on memory alone. They walked 30 paces north from the northwest edge of the stable house. Once there, Aramis dropped to his knees, running his hands over the grass looking for the trap door. Aramis's memory was good. He found the sod-covered trap door after only a few moments. Once the trap door was closed above them, Aramis found a torch against one of the walls. A short time later, the torch was lit and held above their heads so Aaron could see his face.
Keep your voice to a whisper, Aaron. Sound travels farther than light in tunnels such as this.
Aaron touched the monk's arm before he could turn and start down the passage.
Gloria Platt wanted us to know about this passage, didn't she?
Aaron could see the smile on his mentor's face.
Very good, Aaron. I believe you are correct. While she is undoubtedly loyal to the Avedon family, her love for her daughter is even more powerful. And she knows Lord Avedon is hiding something. She wanted us to be able to get back to the mausoleum without having to first go through the manor, whether or not she planned for us to enter the manor undetected.
Aramis left the sentiment unsaid. They moved carefully through the tunnels. Aramis consulted his notes often to make sure they were on course. There were several branching paths where Aramis paused, and most of these passages, Aramis started down them a few paces, but immediately turned and came back. Aaron soon realized that Aramis was checking the side passages for signs of use.
Do you think the killer could have used these passages to get into the manor and murder Greta?
Aramis nodded.
Yes, I do. We have already established that there was little chance the killer could have gotten into and out of the manor's courtyard undetected, unless it was a member of the Avedon family or someone on the manor staff. It is a simple process of elimination. If Greta was not killed by one of these people, then the person or persons that murdered Greta Platt did not use the main entrance of the manor. All we have left is a simple truth. There has to be another way into the courtyard. But the passage we used to get to the underground cemetery began at a gate located behind the manor, by that tree, not from inside the manor. True, but if you recall, there were several side passages near that entrance. Some might turn back towards the manor, and one may even lead us underneath the manor courtyard.
Aaron was struck by the simplicity of it, and then he remembered something from the day before.
The grate! I found this grate behind some shrubs in the courtyard. It looked like it hadn't been opened in years. Rusted, that sort of thing. Constable Lewis said that the courtyard was located directly above the Oviarin Pass, and that workers at one time accessed the pass through the courtyard. He said the grate had been closed and locked down for at least 100 years. How closely did you examine the grate?
I looked down the hole through the metal bars, but I didn't examine the grate itself that closely. It just looked like it hadn't been used in a long time.
Well, maybe that grate leads to somewhere other than the pass. And as for Constable Lewis, it is definitely possible that he only knows what Lord Avedon wants him to know.
The two men grew even more cautious once they reached the Avedon family cemetery. There was no sign of anyone in the large open cavern. Still, Aramis held Aaron back with an arm, hidden in the darkness beyond the last concentration of glow rocks still active in the side tunnel, just to be sure. Once Aramis was certain that the cavern was empty,
He quickly led Aaron across the large cave and its eerie green glow until they reached the cart-wide passage on the other side. They followed this main tunnel, suppressing the desire to investigate every side passage. Eventually, they reached the heavy iron gate they had used to enter the catacombs the day before. Aaron spied the manor from the recessed entryway, concentrating on the door that led into the manor. There was no sign of the constables or any of the regular manor guards. Aaron once again felt Aramis's hand on his arm. The monk motioned for him to follow. Aramis reversed his steps until they reached the first side passage. He walked a few steps into the tunnel, then turned and walked back.
"Nothing has disturbed that passage in a very long time, not even a rodent."
He repeated this at the next passage and at the next one, until they were about a third of the way back to the underground cemetery. Finally, they reached a passage that caused Aramis to go down to one knee. He indicated areas where the layers of dust were not as thick.
"Someone or something has used this tunnel."
Aaron noticed some markings along the bottom edge of the wall.
"Look here, Aramis. It looks like bristle marks."
Aramis nodded.
"Good eyes, pup."
Aaron bowed his head slightly at his companion's joke.
"Yes, master."
Aramis led them down the passage. They encountered several branching intersections, and as they proceeded, they checked the side tunnels for signs of recent use. Eventually, they reached an apparent dead end to the main trail. Aaron rubbed his hands over the wall before them in search of any sign of hidden doors. Aramis held his torch high, examining the low rock ceiling.
"There, Aaron. Can you reach that?"
Aaron spotted what Aramis was talking about, a metal rod that protruded from the ceiling, not unlike the many other pieces of metal that seemed an almost natural element of the cave walls themselves. Miners had used metal bracing to strengthen the walls and ceilings of the tunnels under Avedon Hill, to prevent the walls from collapsing in on them as they worked. Aaron was forced to jump, but when he did so, he easily reached the metal rod. It supported Aaron's weight, but the first jerk of his body caused the bar to shift away from the ceiling. At first, Aaron believed the tunnel was caving in on them, but his fears were unwarranted. While dirt and dust exploded from the ceiling and instantly filled the tunnel, no rocks or metal bracing fell in on them. Still holding on to what he now understood was a handle, Aaron found his feet now touched the tunnel floor. He stared up at an entire section of ceiling that had folded down towards them. Aramis enthusiastically began studying the hinge mechanism, but Aaron could only gaze at the hole above them. It took a moment for his eyes to adjust, but at the other end of the hole, Aaron could make out a small circle of light. The bottom rung of a ladder was just within Aaron's reach. Using the handle for leverage, he pulled himself up to the ladder and then reached below him to help Aramis. As Aramis had suspected, the grate from the courtyard did not connect to the Avedon Pass. It led to the catacombs underneath Avedon Hill. A short time later, they found themselves in the courtyard, hidden behind the line of box-shaped shrubs Aaron had seen the day before, staring at the bench where Greta had sat on so many occasions. The grate had been locked, but only from the inside. There was a small landing below the grate. After they had reached it, Aramis had worked his way past Aaron and unlocked the mechanism that held the grate in place. Once closed behind them, the grate looked the same as it had the day before, as if it had not been opened in 100 years or more. Aramis whispered,
"One mystery solved."
Aaron mouthed words, but barely made sound.
"What now?" "We need to get upstairs without being seen." "Upstairs? There is one Avedon we have yet to meet. I wish to discover why."
Aaron couldn't believe that Aramis was willing to risk a search through the manor in the middle of the night.
"Edvard, you're not buying that Edvard has been ill."
"I am not buying anything anymore." Before Aaron could ask how they were going to get to Edvard without being discovered, Aramis grabbed Aaron by the arm and pulled him to the ground. Immediately thereafter,
they heard the creak of the double doors on the western wall of the courtyard as they opened. Constable Lewis entered the gardens. Luckily, the tall shrubs that blocked the grate from becoming an eyesore for courtyard visitors blocked Aramis and Aaron from Constable Lewis's view. The head constable approached the bench where Greta's body had been found and began searching around and under the bench. Aaron shifted his weight slightly so he could get a better view of Lewis through the branches of the shrubs. The head constable walked in a circular pattern, searching for any evidence that might have been missed. On three separate occasions, Lewis crouched and began pawing at the ground with his gloved hands. In each case, he eventually stopped, pounded the ground once with his fist, and then smoothed the dirt with the palm of his glove. Constable Lewis then made his way back to the stone bench. He sat on it for a time, staring blankly before him. He turned his gaze upward to the stars filling the night sky. Aaron's knees began to ache as he continued watching Lewis from his crouched position. Aramis hadn't moved at all since Lewis had entered the courtyard and showed no signs of discomfort. As they watched, Aaron saw something he had not expected to see. Constable Lewis began to cry. His face fell into his hands and he sobbed silently. But as quickly as it had happened, it was over. Lewis's head shot up, and all three men heard someone walking heavily through the hallway near the west entrance of the courtyard. The head constable regained his composure and stood at near attention as Constable Tanner entered the courtyard.
"Sir, Lord Avedon is calling for you. He's in the grand hall."
Lewis nodded and moved to follow Constable Tanner. Before exiting, however, Lewis scanned the courtyard one last time. Aaron thought Lewis's eyes might meet his no matter how well he was hidden, but instead, Lewis's eyes locked on the upper half of the wall on the north side of the courtyard. And then, he was gone. Relatively certain they would not be disturbed, Aramis stared thoughtfully at the same spot of wall. Aaron whispered,
"What was he looking at?" "If I am correct, beyond that wall lies the hallway where we met Richard Avedon. The six bedrooms of the Avedon family connect to that hall."
Aramis kept low, but moved away from their hiding place towards the eastern wall of the courtyard. Aaron asked his question from earlier.
"How are we going to get upstairs without being seen?"
"You tell me. How many homes, manors, and castles have you visited during your life?"
"Too many to count."
"And how many of these structures did not have secret passages?"
"I asked Constable Lewis about that. He would only say that the mansion has its secrets."
Aaron smiled and began searching the courtyard wall for signs of a secret door. It wasn't long before they found a stone that jutted out slightly farther than most of the others along the eastern wall of the courtyard. Push caused it and several other stones to mechanically recess into the wall. At the same time, other stones were pushed out. It took a few tries to find the right combination of stones to press. The final push caused a small section of wall to slide back, revealing a small, dark, tight passageway. They entered, finding a passage that was not wide enough for Aaron to traverse without turning his shoulders to the side. It took only a single push on the door to seal it seamlessly behind them. Aaron expected Aramis to light another torch, but Aramis instead opened one of his pouches at his belt and pulled out two of the glow rocks he had collected during their initial visit to the caves outside of town. The light was minimal, but it allowed them to proceed safely in the only direction available to them, north. And as if the manor understood exactly where they needed to go, the passage began an ascent, angling up as much as possible without the benefit of stairs. After 20 paces or so, Aaron realized they had probably reached the upper level of the manor. The passage leveled out, reached a wall, and then forced them to turn west. Aramis led them forward. A few moments later, they reached what both men believed would be their exit. Aramis pressed his ear to the wood marking the end of the passage, listening. Satisfied, Aramis placed the glow rocks back in their pouch and then felt around the wood paneling until he found what he was looking for. Slowly, he pushed on a square block of wood near the right edge of the panel. With an audible pop, the door slid slightly to the left, leaving a crack just wide enough for fingers to slip through. Aramis used his right hand to slide the door open and peered into the darkened room beyond the door. Even without direct light, the room was slightly brighter than the secret passage. Yet, both men did not move. The room before them was unfinished, as if it were an afterthought. Aaron recognized that they had still not reached the bedrooms. Before them was what was commonly referred to as a watch room. It was a room that could be used by occupants of the manor in case of attack. The Avedon children could use the watch room to avoid capture, saving the secret passages of the manor as a means of escape only as a last resort. Aaron found himself thinking of his own home, Castle Penn. The prince suddenly realized that the grate hadn't been built as a way for someone to enter the courtyard. He now believed that its original purpose had been to provide a means of escape for the Avedons in case of attack. How ironic. The watch room was not empty. Aaron discerned the outlines of a few pieces of furniture, a possible table in one corner of the room, and some sort of mound in the center of the room. Aaron could not identify what the knee-high mass was, as his eyes were still adjusting to the dim light. But it wasn't the sight of the room that made Aaron hesitate. It was the smell. The stench of death. Direction was unnecessary. Aramis Cragen and Aaron Partee drew their weapons. Aramis held a sai in each hand. Aaron had his sword Wildfire extended before him. Unlike his dream the night before, his sword did not shine or burst into flame, but Aaron knew his blade could cut flesh from bone as well as any weapon ever forged. Though relatively sure the alcove was empty, Aramis used a hand signal to direct Aaron to move cautiously to his left as he moved right. Aaron reached the table that was against the far wall of the room and found the source of the stench, and at the same time identified the mound in the center of the room. It was three Oviaran whitetail carcasses. The watch room had three other doors, one on each wall. Aaron checked the door on the western wall as Aramis listened at the opposite exit. They heard nothing from beyond these doors, but from where both men stood, they picked up at least one voice from behind the door on the northern wall. Aaron, eyes now fully adjusted to the dim light, saw Aramis's hand signal, "Stay," and nodded. Aramis approached the northern wall, placed a hand on the door, and leaned in to lay his ear against the wood. But before his ear reached its intended post, the door exploded in on them, sending shards of wood in all directions. Aaron watched as Aramis was thrown back past him along the ground. Dazed for a moment, all Aaron could hear was a horrible sound somewhere between a growl and a hiss, and all he saw was a shape crouching at the now mangled doorway to the watchroom. Not knowing Aramis's condition, Aaron allowed his instincts to take over and charged. Okay, thanks for sticking around. I finally got to cliffhanger, you guys. Thanks to J.C. Hutchins for coining that term. Hopefully that'll get you to come back next time for episode 22 to find out what happens next. Right now, though, I want to talk a little bit about what's coming up in May, some appearances that are taking place, and some information about the website, and some other things. So, first of all, appearances. On May 17th, and stay tuned later because I've got a promo that's coming out to talk specifically about this. On May 17th, I will be appearing at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, North Carolina for a panel on new media. This is with the Raleigh
write to publish group, a writer's group based out of Raleigh. And we'll be talking, Murr and I, and a blogger named Lisa Lorello, I believe, will be talking about new media, blogging, podcasting, and building a potential audience through new media. Then, at the end of May, I will be at Balticon in Hunt Valley, Maryland, just outside of Baltimore, and I will be on panels there. This is from May, it's Memorial Weekend, May 23rd through the 26th, and I'll be on several panels and talking about the book and about podcasting, and I hope anybody in that area, there's going to be a lot of podcasters there, a lot of podcast novelists, and, you know, other than Dragon Con, I think it is the place to be. If you are a fan of podcasting and podcast novels, especially. Next thing, just wanted to talk briefly about the website. We've added a couple pages to the website. One is a photos page, which has some very neat photos, at least for me, of some people that have purchased the novel and have sent me pictures. In one case, Nick Robinson, who lives in Scotland, has sent a picture, multiple pictures of him, not only with a book, but with a t-shirt that he purchased from Cafe Press from the novel. I've had the Cafe Press store for a while, but I haven't really advertised it. I'm actually going to be opening up a store at spreadshirt.com. So anybody that is interested in a Murder at Avedon Hill t-shirt, it'll be posted on the website as soon as it is up and running. And again, that's at spreadshirt.com. Next thing I want to talk about is there is a loyal listener, which I've mentioned before, Nick Robinson. He's the guy that sent some great pictures of him holding not only the book, but a t-shirt for Murder at Avedon Hill. And he and three of his friends are doing something very special in the UK. They are planning on doing a bike ride to bring awareness and raise money for the Alzheimer's Society. They are basically over a 9-day period, riding their bikes over 950 miles from the north east corner of the UK, John O'Groats, to Land's End in the far southwest, which again is around 950 miles. And what I would like you to do, if you can't contribute, that's fine, but at least go over to justgiving.com/4AS and leave a comment. They need all the motivation they can get about what they're trying to do, and hopefully you can contribute some money as well, because Nick's a great guy and this is a great cause. So thanks to Nick for bringing this to my attention, and again, please go visit their site at justgiving.com/4AS, Alzheimer's Society. Other things to talk about, just wanted to let everybody know, I am now 40 years old. And I had my birthday on the 16th, and it was a great birthday. Two gifts I got, which are directly impacting the podcast. One is an Zoom H2 recorder, which I'm actually recording my intro and outro in this week. It's a great little product, and it will be helping me. I was able to, instead of going down to my studio and re-recording certain lines, I was able to just go in the closet, re-record in the H2, and the lines, we're just able to edit those in seamlessly, and hopefully no one will be able to tell the difference. In addition, probably the best gift I got was a set of Sennheiser HD 280 Pro headphones. And oh my god, what a great set of headphones. Podcasters always say headphones are, you know, if you're going to upgrade, everybody talks about upgrading your microphone, upgrade your headphones. I now understand what they mean. Not just the sound quality, but the comfort of wearing these headphones. I can actually sit and edit and listen to what I'm doing when working with the audio files for a lot longer stretches of time without my ears hurting wearing these headphones. So please, anybody that's working in podcasting or audio in general, if you don't already know this, I'm sure you do, but I was slow to learn, please go upgrade your headphones, and the Sennheisers are great. Also, before leaving for Balticon later this month, I hope to be able to not only release episode 23, which should be the climax of part one of Murder at Avedon Hill, but also I'm hoping to use Ustream, which is a video website a lot of video podcasters use to stream their podcasts. I'm hoping to use Ustream and do a live reading around May 21st. That's the date I'm shooting for right now, doing a live reading of chapter 23. You know, we'll see how that goes, and you'll hear more about that, and hope people can come out, go to Ustream's website, and I'll have a, you know, URL that to send you to, and you'll be able to see me do a live reading of episode 23 the same night that I drop it into the feed. So again, more information on that later. And lastly, before I go, before we get to the promo that I'm going to be playing for the bookstore appearance, I wanted to thank Heather Welliver for her intro bumper at the beginning of the episode, and her music is wonderful, and you will hear, not only hear her song, their song, Faithful, in the promo that we'll be playing, but also at the end of the episode, after the promo, I'm going to play the full song of Faithful. And for those of you that complain about too much promos, too much chatter, sorry, I love the song. I'm playing it. And again, that's why that we have the Podiobooks feed. If you don't like me talking, please go over to Podiobooks and subscribe to the podcast there. Anyway, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Later. Ooh, email. Oh, look at that. Confirmed. Wow, my first bookstore panel. Only a year into this thing, and I get to talk to a group of writers about new media and how to build an audience through podcasting.
PG.
I'll dazzle them. I'll inspire them.
PG.
And just think of the potential new listeners for Murder at Avedon Hill. And they'll learn from someone who's been there.
Patrick.
Yes, Mer?
I'm on the panel too, you know.
Oh, I see.
PG.
Sorry.
Say it.
Mer is the light. Mer is mighty. Mer is the one.
Good. See you on the 17th.
Join Mer Lafferty, author of The Heaven Series and Playing for Keeps, PG Holyfield, and writer-blogger Lisa Lorello on May 17th at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, North Carolina, for a panel discussion called Podcasting, Blogs, and Self-Publishing, New Ways to Reach Audiences with Your Book. For more information on this Raleigh Write to Publish event, please visit pgholyfield.com, merverse.com, or join the meetup group at writers.meetup.com/500. Been listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, a podcast novel written and produced by PG Holyfield. Please visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this novel and the author. Most of the music in this podcast generously provided by Shira Common through magnatune.com. magnatune.com, they are not evil. Additional music generously provided by Kevin McLeod through his website at incompetech.com. Be sure to check out Murder at Avedon Hill at podiobooks.com, and if you are so inclined, please post a review at iTunes, at Podcast Pickle, or at podiobooks.com. Audio comments about the podcast can be left on the Cairn line at 704-315-5884, or go to pgholyfield.com and click on the Call Me button to leave comments. This podcast is copyright 2007-2008 by PG Holyfield and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license.